Canada and Montana were two places I'd always wanted to visit. And this time I've been able to do both. And I'm very thrilled at the experience. A lot of you I know have already heard my tapes and lectures and so forth. I don't know if you know that I hardly ever write a paper or a lecture. I can't. I'm hopeless at writing, getting it all together. It looks awful and it sounds awful. So I've learned just to pray and to listen. So what's going to come out today will be as new to me as it is to you. I don't know if that worries you. But don't worry, I've done it before. So we start at the title of today's talk, The Love of God in Christian Science Nursing. Now, the year before last, I was invited to address a Christian Science Nursing facility in California. And the chairman of this committee called me up to see if I would come and speak at their annual meeting, and I said I would love to. So she said she would tell the board I was going to come and she would contact me soon. Well, about 2 weeks later, and I'd been busy with other things, I hadn't given as much thought, she caught me up and she said, do you have a title for your talk? I said, a title? I don't even have a talk. And she said, well, we're going to print. Then I go to the printers tomorrow and we've got to have a title. And she said, please, you have to come up with something. So I stood and thought and thought, and then the thought came to me that the greatest of these is love. And I thought I could go there and I could talk about nursing, about Christian Science nursing. But if I talk about love, it covers everything. So I said, the title to my talk is The Greatest of These is Love. That, as you know, comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And after I went off the phone, I thought, what have I done? How can anybody talk about such a subject? Do I know enough about love? And then I began to think of experiences that I've had in my life. And to realize I know a lot about God's love because it's been proved in my experience. So I think that I'll start your talk as I did theirs by reading 1 Corinthians. I remember this man, Paul, who wrote this, had been a murderer. He murdered Christians. Can you see the change in this man's life? And then his whole experience, that he should write one of the most important chapters in the Bible. And if he can change, anybody can change. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, and have not charity, I am become a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy, and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains, and have not charity, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Charity suffereth long, and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Charity never faileth, but whether there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know, even as also I am known. And now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three. But the greatest of these is charity. Follow after charity. Follow after love. The search for love is wonderful. The search to really learn how to love and how to forgive is the most wonderful search that I've had in my experience. Because as you already know from my tips, I was married to a very violent man. A man who deprived me and my children of a lot of good in our lives. And there were actually times when I felt that I hated this man. Not just for what he had done to me, but for what he had done to my children. How I had to move house 8 times in about 2 years. And every time we found a house, he would find us and he would wreck the house and he would even take the food from the fridge. And it was hard for me to put that food into the fridge in the first place. And there were times that I really felt that I hated him and wanted him dead. And I knew that that wasn't right, that it was me who needed healed. So I used to pray, it's me, O Lord, stand in the need of prayer. Not my brother, not my sister, it's me, O Lord. And I prayed, I really, really prayed that God could teach me to see through the mist, to see what he saw in this man, and to be able to love him. And for 2 years, I studied everything I could in the Bible and in Mrs. Eddy's writings on love. And I tried to put this love into practice, in my practice and with my family and even with terrorists in our community. But when it came to this one person, it seems as if I couldn't see through it. But it gradually began to lessen and lessen and lessen until I could. I used to have a fear if I went into town, I would meet him, he would run after me, threaten me, abuse me verbally in the street. And I always had this dread. And after I began to love this way, the dread began to go. And then the time came for me to divorce him. I knew that it was wisdom to do that, even though I still wanted to learn to love him. I knew I had to learn to love him, whether I was married or divorced. And so we went through the divorce. And on the day of our divorce, the judge questioned him first. And he was in the witness box all morning. And then we had a break for lunch, and he and I sat in the room outside with a policeman and a policewoman, and he was still threatening me and wanting to abuse me. And I was saying to myself, I don't care what you say or what you do, I know that you are the loved Son of God and that God loves you, and I refuse to be taken in by this. We got back into the witness box, and he was there until 4 o'clock. Because every time the judge asked him a question, he would tell a lie. And then that lie had to be unwound, and the judge would have to go back and point out things. And I saw that by 4 o'clock, the whole court was weary. Everybody who worked there looked absolutely tired and weary. And at 4 o'clock, the judge suddenly looked up, and he said to him, You are the worst liar, cheat, violent person that I have ever met. And he said, I don't know why I'm even questioning you, because this woman wants a divorce. She wants a divorce. Why should I ask you questions? He said, I'm going to grant that divorce and say this woman should have had it years ago, and good luck to her. And the judge turned to me then and he said, well, Mrs. Smith, you haven't had a chance to say anything. Is there anything that you would like to say? And I said, yes, Your Honor, there is. And I got into the witness box. And I said, Your Honor, it may look to you and to everyone in this court as though my husband were all bad, but there's nobody all bad. And I said, I would like to tell you some good things that he did. I said, because of him, I have five beautiful, wonderful children who are behind me 100%. My husband served 12 years in the Royal Marines, and he was always kind to animals. There was a kindness about him. And I said, this man isn't a bad man, Your Honor. He's a sick man. And I hope that you can understand that and see it. And when I looked, the judge was weeping. Everybody in the court was weeping. And the judge said, Mrs. Smith, you've made my day. And suddenly, my husband jumped up, and because he had a mental problem, he couldn't quite see what was happening. He jumped up and he said, what's happening? What's happening? And his barrister, who was a young woman, went over and pushed him down into a seat. And she said, you're divorced. And I wished I'd been your wife's barrister. And you know, I remember leaving that court and I went over and I kissed him. I took his two hands and I kissed him. And he looked totally bewildered. And I left that court feeling 10 foot tall because I felt I'd come full circle. I'd love to love. I've learned to love where somebody else hated. And you've no idea just what that experience did for me. A year after we were divorced, he became very ill, and I insisted that my children help me to nurse him because they didn't want anything to do with him. And I knew that if he should die, that they would go through their lives with regrets, and I didn't want that. So we all helped to nurse him until he passed on, and we all were able to feel a compassion and tenderness for him that I had never known before. Now, I didn't do that through some human power of my own or through human will. It was through the understanding of divine love that I was gaining. And that's what we're here to talk about today, about the power of God's love in Christian Science Nursing. The power of divine love, not human love. Now, we have to separate that. We have to make the difference, because sometimes we can be so busy doing human good that we haven't time to study. And that becomes the good that comes in the guise of evil. It takes us away from the study. The best way to do anybody, anywhere, any good is to see them as God's child. I had a sister whose husband was crippled with arthritis. He had it since he was a boy, and it got worse and worse and worse. They would have nothing to do with Christian Science, neither one of them. And he believed that when he died, his suffering would be over and he would go straight to heaven. And I tried many, many times to offer Christian Science to them, but to no avail. Well, one time my sister called me, and she said she was feeling very unwell, and she just couldn't cope with Tom because she had to do everything for him. So I said, well, I'll come over and help you. Now, at that time, my children were young, and I had to catch two different buses when they went off to school. And I would stop in the city center, and because he couldn't work, and she couldn't work, they had very little income. And so I would stop at a store in town and buy some bits of food and bring them to them and do all our vacuuming and shopping and so forth. And I did this for 3 days. And on the third day, I went home, and my own house hadn't been done for 3 days. It was in a mess. I was irritable. I couldn't even really afford these bus fares. And I stopped and said, "And Myrtle, just what are you doing here? Are you really helping your sister and her husband?" And I began to say, "No, I'm trying to humanly do something for them. And when I do that, I am believing that they are people in great need." So that night I decided that the next day I was going to stay in and I was really going to pray to clear my own thought of this situation. Now, they didn't want my prayer, so I couldn't specifically pray for them. But I could pray for me to rid my consciousness of the belief that they were in these dire circumstances. So I called my sister and I told her I wouldn't be there, and she was at first disappointed. But the next day I got out the lesson sermon and I really prayed with it to know that they were God's beloved children and that God takes care of his own and that he meets people right where they are, just like the master got into the boat with the disciples. He didn't ask the disciples to walk on the water. So I didn't have to ask them to walk on the water, but I could know that divine love would meet their need right where they were. Well, the next day my sister called and she said, "You know, we are both so much better today." I remember I did not pray specifically for them. I prayed for me to know that I couldn't be hypnotized into believing that somebody was a cripple or an invalid, and that somebody else was burdened by looking after this invalid. I couldn't be hypnotized by that. Then my sister told me that the doctor came to see them, and the doctor said to her that he thought that she was entitled to some sort of grant for looking after him. He sent out a social worker. The social worker said she certainly was. She was entitled to 3 different grants. They were back paid for 2 years. This social worker got him chairs, a nurse to come twice a day to bath him, lots of different things in ways that they could understand where they were at. They didn't have to walk on the water. They didn't have to be healed. Now, that was a great lesson for me. And some years after that, my sister died very suddenly, and her husband was left an invalid. And they only had 1 daughter who was married to an army officer, and they lived in Germany. He had 7 months to do in Germany and was not allowed to bring his father-in-law because of his condition, because he couldn't move a muscle from his neck down. So they were looking for somewhere for my brother-in-law to go. Now, they asked his sister, they asked his nieces, they asked my 2 brothers and my sister, and nobody wanted to take them. And I had offered, and Tom kept saying no. And I knew it was because I was a Christian Scientist. Anyway, in the end, he had no choice. It was either the hospital or me. So he chose me. But that was the only reason that he chose me. So I brought him home, and I had to make a bed downstairs for him in the room downstairs, because there was no way anybody could get him upstairs. And every night for 3 weeks, I left a little bell by his bed, and I told him he was to ring this bell if he needed me. And every night for 3 weeks, this bell would ring. Now, at this time, it was winter, and I had a burst pipe. I didn't have the money to pay for a plumber, so I couldn't light fires, and I had to keep him warm, and I had seven different electric fires in his bedroom, and he wasn't paying me any money, and I was going through great hardship. Also, every night he would ring this bell, and I would have to come down and tend to him, and my sister used to have to do this a lot in the night. Well, at this time, I think it was because of the resentment, I fell and broke my ankle. And I had nurses come in to care for him, the same nurses that care for him at home. And one night the nurse came in and she said, won't you let me take you to the hospital? She said, I see the bone sitting out in your foot and it's very badly broken. And I said, no, I'm a Christian Scientist. And Tom mockingly said, oh, she's a Christian Scientist. They don't go to doctors, they just suffer broken feet. And so I was quite resentful about a lot of this. And one night I had a patient, and this patient talked to me at 2 a.m. And when I finished, I was really tired. I got into bed and I said, please God, don't let that bell ring tonight. But I just got into bed and what do you think happened? The bell rang. So I had to hobble all the way down and the tears were running down my cheeks. And I was saying to myself, Myrtle, you must be the biggest mug in Ireland. Taking this man into your house, he doesn't even want to be here. He doesn't want to pay you. He's so resentful. He would say, don't give me any of Christian Science literature. You're not going to brainwash me. Don't bring it in here. I said to myself, what on earth am I doing? Well, I got to the bottom step of the stairs, and this little voice that saves us all said, now, Myrtle, what way were you speaking to your patient half an hour ago? Weren't you calling her dear? Weren't you telling her how much God loved her, that she could never be outside his tender, loving care? Well, do you think Christian Scientists have the monopoly? Do you think that God doesn't love that poor man in there as much as he loved your patient? And I said, no, Father, I know that you love all, but your love's impartial and universal, and I know that you love him. Just let me love him like that. And then I remembered that Mrs. Eddy, when she came to the Mother Church, before she went on the platform, she stood back and let the Christ go before her. So I opened the door and stood back and prayed that the Christ would go before me. I went into the room and Tom was in tears, and I asked him what his problem was. And he said that he had a sore on his leg and he had kicked it with the other leg and the top had come off it. And he said, do you have any ointment or cream or something you can put on it? And I said, no, the only thing I have in the house is baby lotion. And he said, well, maybe that would cool it. So I had to go all the way back up to the bathroom with this broken leg and down again. But this time I was much kinder and calmer, and I got this baby lotion. I was dabbing it on his leg. When suddenly he said to me, Myrtle, you know, I never wanted to come to your house. I was almost ready to go to a hospital because I resented Christian Science and everything to do with it. I thought it was wrong and it was evil. But I want to tell you that I have never felt so close to God or felt his presence like I felt it in your house. And when you were bathing my leg right now, he said, I felt like Jesus was doing it. And that Jesus was saying to me, I'll never leave you, Tom. I'll always care for you. I was so grateful. We both burst into tears, and he put his poor twisted arms up and gave me a hug. And I said, you know, Tom, I miss my sister too. And we sat and we talked about her. And on a Sunday morning, I hadn't been going to church because I didn't want to leave him. But on a Sunday morning, I decided it's time I went to church because I needed to be sustained myself with the truth that was there if I were to go on helping him. So I got him ready, and there was a special chair for him to sit in. I got him put in the chair, and I put his pipe. He smoked the pipe, and I put the telephone beside him, and I said, now, Tom, I'm going to church this morning. And he began to cry, and he said, well, Lily wouldn't go to church. She wouldn't leave me. And I said, I'm not Lily. I'm not married to you, Tom. I am going to church because I need church. And I'll only be away about an hour and a half. And you said, well, I don't know what to do with myself whenever you go out. And my sister, this was November, and my sister had already bought all her Christmas presents and her Christmas cards. And I handed him a pile of these cards, and I said, why did you write those cards? He said, because I can't even sign my name. I haven't written anything for 15 years. And I said, well, the Sabbath day is a good day to try. So I'm leaving them beside you. And I went to church and sat in church and thought, am I being too hard? Am I being cruel? And I thought, no, I remember that the best nurse gets you on your feet. That's the best way to love. And when I came back, Tom was so excited. He had written 15 cards. Within a week, he had written 87 cards. And he wrote letters to people, something that he hadn't done for years. And we became such good friends. And when my patients would come to see me, they would go in and say hello to Tom, and he would play chess with them. And he gave me money for his keep. And then after 7 months, he went to England to live with his daughter. And when he finally died, which was, 10 years later or something, he told his daughter that he wanted to go home to my house when he died, that he wanted to be buried from there and be buried with my sister. And he said, you know, next to you and your mother, your Aunt Myrtle is the dearest thing on earth to me. Wasn't that such a healing? But it taught me so much about nursing. You know, we're all nurses. And what are we nursing? Now, I was nursing resentment, self-pity, anger, frustration, poverty. How can you be a nurse and nurse those qualities? So I knew that I had to nurse the Christ-like qualities that are in each man. You and I, we're all nurses. And if we nurse and cherish God-like qualities, then we become nurses. I have this poem that somebody at home gave me about nurses, which I'd like to read to you. What do you see, nurse? What do you see? What are you thinking when you're looking at me? A crabbed old woman, not very wise, uncertain of habit with faraway eyes, who dribbles her food and makes no reply when you say in a loud voice, I do wish you'd try. Who seems not to notice the things that you do, and forever is losing a stocking or shoe, who, unresisting or not, let you do as you will with bathing and feeding the long days to fill. Is that what you're thinking? Is that what you see? Then open your eyes, nurse. You're not looking at me. I'll tell you who I am as I sit here so still, as I rise at your bidding and eat at your will. I'm a small child of 10, with a father and mother, brothers and sisters who love one another. A girl of 16 with wings on her feet, dreaming that soon now a lover she'll meet. A bride soon at 20, my heart gives a leap, remembering the vows I promised to keep. At 25 now, I have young of my own, who need me to build a secure, happy home. A woman of 30, my young now grow fast, bound to each other with ties that should last. At 40, my young ones now grown will be gone, but my man stays beside me to see I don't mourn. At 50, once more babies play round my knee, again we know children, my loved one and me. Dark days are upon me, my husband is dead. I look to the future and shudder with dread, for my young ones are all busy rearing young of their own, and I think of the years and the love I have known. I'm an old woman now, and nature is cruel, 'cause her jest to make old age look a fool. The body it crumbles, grace and vigor depart, though now is a stone where I once had a heart. But inside this carcass a young girl still dwells, and now and again my battered heart swells. I remember the joys, I remember the pain, and I'm loving and living life over again. And I think of the years, all too few, gone too fast, and accept the stark fact that nothing can last. So open your eyes, nurse, open and see, not a crabbed old woman. Look closer, see me. That was signed by a woman called Kate, who had had a stroke, and the nurses used to see her writing, and when she passed on, they'd find this poem in her locker. And I love it because I think as nurses or as people, we need to be able to see through the false picture that mortal's mind is throwing out. You know, it says somewhere in the New Testament, what went ye out for to see? I read, shaken with the wind. Is that what we're seeing? Is that what we're seeing in our loved ones? Is that what we're seeing in our church members? Is that what we're seeing in our world? Well, we have to really love by saying, I refuse to see what God can't see. Mrs. Eddy tells us in the textbook that Jesus beheld in science the perfect man who appeared to him where sinning mortal man appears to mortals. And this correct view of man healed the sick. Are we holding a correct view of man? I don't think many of us do that consistently. Even as Christian scientists, we don't do it for ourselves. We still think we're a mortal who has a long way to go, a mortal who needs healing of so many things and so many problems, that we're starting out from the wrong premise. How many times today have you claimed your immortality? I tell the truth. Put up your hand, anybody who did it today. You do it every day? Consistently? I know every day when I wake up that I was never born into matter. I never grew up in matter. I was never conditioned into or by matter, and I can never die out of matter, that I'm nobody's child, I'm nobody's grandchild, I'm nobody's wife, I'm nobody's mother, and I'm nobody's grandmother. I am the child of God. I am that I am, not this I am. I used to wonder why God told Moses to tell people I am that I am. I said to himself, well, that's a queer thing to tell anybody. Like, imagine today if you said to somebody, what's your name? And he said, I am that I am. Well, you would think he was round the bend, wouldn't you? But I have come to see that that is a natural truth that we have to say, no, I am not this I am. That I'm trying to convince myself that I am, or that the world is trying to convince me that I am, even my own family. I am not this I am. I am that I am. And that I am is God. The only I am, the I am of your being. You are God in action. You are the expression of God's being. And what is God? Infinite Spirit, infinite wisdom, infinite love, infinite truth, infinite mind, intelligence, wisdom, principle, all in all. And you are the very expression of that. Right now, not when you get more money or meet somebody nice to fall in love with, or when you move house, or you have a holiday, or you get healed of something. Right now, are we the sons of God? That's what we get read from our desk every Sunday morning. How much attention do we pay to it? Beloved, now are we the sons of God. Right now, not in half an hour, not next week, not tomorrow. Now are we the sons of God. And it doth not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he shall appear, when we see him clearly, we shall certainly be like him. For we shall see him as he is. And every man that hath this hope in him, every man has this hope in him, whether he knows it or not, purifieth himself, even as he is pure. And then we have read every Sunday the scientific statement of being. Look how many times it says is in there. There is no life, truth, intelligence, nor substance in matter. All is infinite mind, and its infinite manifestation. For God is all in all. Spirit is immortal truth. Matter is mortal error. Spirit is the real and eternal. Matter is the unreal and temporal. Spirit is God, and man is his image and likeness. Therefore, man is not material. He is spiritual. How often do we look in the mirror in the morning and say, oh, look at me. Don't I look a mess? Well, I'm learning to say, no, you're not going to mesmerize me because that's not me. That has nothing to do with me. I think it's somewhere in Robert Peel's book, he said that Mary Baker Eddy used to go down to the bottom of the garden and deny all the things that were supposed to have happened to Mary today. Yet not one of those things happened to Mary today. They were not true. Because Mary is the perfect child of God. And we have to do that too. We have to wake up and see that really this whole existence is just a dream, that is nothing else. Now we're talking about the power of love in nursing. Oh, by the way, I want to mention, you notice in this leaflet that there's a poem inside called The Christ. Now this poem was sent to me by someone that I helped in prison. Someone who had a marvelous healing of blindness and diabetes. He was a loyalist terrorist and was in there for murder. The first murder that happened 25 years ago. This man's whole nature just became so changed that he sent me this poem. And there's the third line from the bottom where it says the word is shared, it should be shed. Not merely in the words you say, not only in your deeds expressed, but in the most unconscious way is Christ expressed. Is it a beatific smile, a holy light upon your brow? Oh no. I felt his presence when you laughed just now. To me, it was not the truth you taught. To you, so clear. To me, so dim. But when you came, You brought a sense of him, and from your eyes he beckons me, and from your heart his love is shed, till I lose sight of you and see the Christ instead. I used to have a great practice if I was out going shopping in the morning or to the market or sitting in a bus, that I would declare that every person I met today or I'm about to meet today is the beloved child of God, is God in action. And I'm going to see that in each person. And each person that comes in contact with me or that I pass, I am going to salute the Christ in that person. And do you know that the Christ always responds? People will be walking by and they'll give you such a warm smile. Little children do it. You just know that they are responding to the Christ, to the truth about their identity. And you know that's what the whole world is crying out for. Everybody's crying out for somebody to identify them spiritually. A practitioner, every time she answers the phone, that person is not just looking for healing. They are saying, will somebody identify me correctly? That's what their need is. Their need isn't for money or a new home or a physical healing or to get out of some situation. They are saying, will somebody please identify me correctly? The Christ in you is standing at the door of my consciousness. And what am I going to admit? Am I going to admit your humanity? Am I going to say, oh, he's getting older, or he doesn't look well, or I don't like this person, I don't like the way they speak? What am I going to admit? Because remember, you're admitting it into your consciousness. So if you open the door of your consciousness and you admit old age everywhere, poverty, terrorism, gangsters, dishonesty, immorality, you're letting it into the door of your own consciousness, and your consciousness and mine would be poisoned, and that keeps us from seeing the Christ clearly. Although we're reading the truth and we're taking in all this stuff, we're like a bird with one wing, and one wing's on the ground, and it can never get that other wing off the ground. And we sometimes wonder why. I've done all this reading, I've done all this study, but I can't take off for flight. Well, that's usually why that wing is stuck to the ground. Because we're seeing everybody around us through our human eyes and ears and senses. And we're not doing them any good, but we're not doing ourselves any good either. Now, you know, practitioners are guilty of that just as well as anybody else. We all do it because we have to put off this humanity. But I learned a great lesson about that in Northern Ireland. Quite a few years ago, might have been sort of halfway through the 25 years of trouble. And there was a hunger strike in Northern Ireland. I'm sure you remember that. It was world news. These terrorists didn't like the conditions in the prison. So they took off all their clothes and they just wore a blanket. And they sat in their little cells and they painted the walls with their own human dirt, and they said they were going to strike to the death. Well, this was world news. It was getting televised right throughout the world. It was on our television. And everywhere we went, people were talking about it and talking about it. Well, two of these hunger strikers had died. And one night I was up late doing practice work. And I was doing practice work, but just watch what my thinking was after that. I switched on the news and it said, a third hunger striker is about to die. He's been taken to hospital. He's blind, and he's only been given 3 days to live. Guess what my thoughts were? I had been practicing all night. My thought was, good. That would be one less to worry about. Why should the taxpayer pay to keep him? Now, I justified my angry thoughts by thinking about the terrible atrocities that these people had committed, blowing up homes and businesses and little children and people. Now, I thought that my anger was justified. But thank God he never lets us away with anything. Because for some reason, that hunger striker didn't die, excuse me, and I never heard the real reason why. Not long after that, this hunger strike went over. But one Sunday morning, several months after this, I was preparing to go to church, and I had on the radio, because there was a program on there, a religious program,